This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetteSurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at NECU.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. For comedian Maz Gibrani, acts of terrorism feel somehow personal. Here he is on his I Come in Peace comedy tour.
Like, I don't know if you guys remember this, a couple years ago in Times Square, there was a Pakistani guy who tried to blow up a car bomb in Times Square. Now, I happened to be there that night doing shows just a few blocks away. And a few months before that, in Austin, Texas, there was a white guy who flew his plane into the IRS building in Austin, Texas. And I happened to be in Austin, Texas that day doing a show. Yeah. Yeah. As a Middle Eastern male, when you start showing up around a lot of these activities, you start feeling guilty at one point. I was watching the news. I'm like, am I involved in this crap?
You may recognize Maz as a Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me panelist, but he's also an actor with several films and TV shows to his credit and a comedian who's performed stand-up all over the world. He's also author of a new memoir, I'm Not a Terrorist, But I've Played One on TV. And Maz Gibrani, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me. How you doing?
Well, I'm very well and very excited to talk with you because, you know, I've wondered what it's like for someone who is of Middle Eastern descent. You know, you're joking there about profiling yourself after so many experiences of being profiled. And I couldn't help but wonder if comedy is a way of getting to the truth. What part of that is true for you?
Well, you know, it is. I think comedy, I always say, is like therapy. And we talk about the truth and we laugh at it. We laugh through it, I guess. A lot of that is true. I mean, it's funny because ultimately, I personally have never been profiled at an airport, but I have friends and family who've had things happen to them. I read about it all the time. And so eventually it gets in your head. So I know specifically after September 11th, the first time I traveled, I felt guilty. I didn't know why. I hadn't done anything, but there was so much, I think, antagonism towards people that look like me that I felt like I was going to be stopped and interrogated. It's that feeling of when you go through that metal detector and you feel like something's going to beep. Mm. That got to like a really extreme place. So it's interesting. I talk about it in the book. I talk about getting these silly ideas in your head of like, maybe like there's some organization who knows of me and they're doing terrorist things around where I am. I don't know what. So this weird paranoia sets in. I don't know why.
Well, you do have the realization also that being a comic would be a pretty perfect cover for being a terrorist. Why is that?
Absolutely. Well, I talk about that in the book, but I say, you know, it would be an interesting conversation where, you know, your terrorist leader would say, you know, you go, you do your shows, you get them to like you, and then when the timing is right, you kill them. And then it becomes confusing because you go, kill them with laughter or kill them? He's like, no, kill them. And you're like, but I'd rather kill them with laughter, you know, and it gets confusing after a while. How do you kill them?
Well, maybe you haven't been profiled in an airport, but you were typecast long before September 11th. You dropped out of UCLA. You were on the stand-up circuit, and the manager, was it at the Comedy Store, told you to wear the outfit, you know, like a robe and a turban.
Yeah, you know, Mitzi Shore, who's the owner of the Comedy Store, and she, I always preface this story by saying I owe a lot of my career to her because the Comedy Store in Los Angeles is this mecca of comedy. You want to be a regular at this club and be there and grow. And the way you become a regular is by auditioning in front of Mitzi Shore. This was when she was healthier. She's a little older now and she's not at the club anymore. And the night when I auditioned, I remember doing the set. And as I was walking off the stage, she goes, congratulations, you're very funny. That's how she talks. And I go, thank you, Mitzi. And she goes, I'm going to make you a regular. I go, thank you. She goes, have you ever thought about wearing the outfit? And I was like, outfit? She goes, yeah, you know, the hat and the gown. And then she makes kind of a circly gesture. And I go, oh, like a turban. He's like, yeah, I think you should wear that. And then I have this moment in my mind where I'm like, do I say no and stand up for my principles? Or do I accept and, you know, sell my soul? And I basically was like, yeah, Mitzi, that's a great idea. I'll definitely wear the outfit.
But and, you sort of played the stereotype to get out of it, too. How'd you do that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I turned the card so fast because I had like a week or two of just trying to get out of wearing the turban. And finally, I remembered hearing that there was an Iranian performer in Los Angeles who used to make fun of the mullahs. And supposedly, I guess he was at an event. Some Iranians showed up. They threw a rock and they blinded him in an eye. So I called up the club and I said, listen, I don't know if you guys have heard about this, but these guys take it seriously, and I could wear a turban, but if I do, they may show up and they may attack me. Worse yet, they may attack the club. And so they said, you know what? Just wear something casual. And I got out of that one.
Well, this has come up for you over and over in one of your early movie roles. You played a terrorist in a Chuck Norris film. And mind you, Chuck Norris did play a college professor in that same film. But there was kind of a moment of clarity for you about that role and what you wanted to do in the future. What happened for you?
It was early in my career. I had a day job at an advertising agency. I was an assistant. I was hoping to find more film and TV work that would let me quit my day job. So I got this gig on this Chuck Norris movie of the week, and I was playing an Afghan terrorist who was going to blow up a building in Chicago. This was pre-9/11. And I thought, okay, you know what? At least I'll get it right. Because, you know, as you said, you know, Chuck is doing something different. He's going to be a professor in this movie. I was like, maybe they're thinking outside the box here. So I went to the wardrobe fitting, and I was playing an Afghan in America. And they go, here's your shirt, here's your pants, here's your turban. And I was like, oh. I go, listen, let's get this right. You know, Afghans don't wear turbans. Indian Sikhs in America wear turbans. And they're like, dude, this is a Chuck Norris movie. What are you talking about? And finally, I said, listen, you tell the producers I'm not going to wear the turban. It's not right. It's not the right thing to do. So I showed up the next day, and there's my shirt, there's my pants, and there's what looks like a scarf. So I was like, oh, scarf. I go, I have no problem being a scarf-wearing terrorist. And she's like, that's not a scarf. That's the turban. You got to wrap it around your head. I was like, oh, man. And then when I came back to Los Angeles, I told my agents and that no more terrorist parts.
Well, so what happened then? What kind of role could you get?
I've played cab drivers. I've played falafel shop owners. I don't mind those parts because I feel like I know those people. When I go to New York, when I go to Chicago, you know, there's people like that that own these places or drive the cabs. But I've never met a terrorist. I don't know a terrorist. And the bigger thing about the terrorist thing is that I feel like it's such a small percentage of the population, yet it represents the population so much in American film and television. You know, I've heard about recently, anytime there's backlash against Muslims or Arabs or Iranians or people from that part of the world, I've heard that there's been a lot of backlash and a lot of things where other kids are either beating up kids that are from those backgrounds or teasing them, and you realize, wow, my playing a part sometimes could actually add fuel to that fire. Mm-hmm. So
I'm speaking with the actor and comedian, Wait, Don't Tell Me panelist, and now author Maaz Jobani. His new memoir is called I'm Not a Terrorist, But I Played One on TV. Well, let's talk about you growing up. You came to the U.S. long before any of these roles and before the 1979 revolution. Your impression of America was largely formed through television shows like The $6 Million Man, like Dallas Dynasty. So what did you expect when you came here, you know? Big hair and cowboy hats?
Yeah, I was 6 years old, and it was right before the Iranian Revolution. I always say that a lot of people didn't realize the revolution was actually going to happen. My father was on business in New York, and at the time it was our winter break from school, so he sent for my mother to bring my sister and me to New York to be with him for a couple of weeks during our winter break. And I always say we packed for 2 weeks, we stayed for 35 years or whatever it is now. And as a kid, I didn't know much. I remember coming to America. My father was a successful businessman, so he was staying at the Plaza Hotel in New York, and it happened to be right across the street from FAO Schwartz.
You were in heaven.
Yeah, I'm like, wow, America is amazing. And And I was thinking, this revolution is really working out for me. And I was just a kid, and none of the geopolitical stuff really hit me until, I believe, when we moved out to Northern California, and that's around the time the hostage crisis happened. And I talk about in the book about having a sixth grader pick on me for being from Iran and calling me an effing Iranian. That's what they called you back then.
Iranian.
Mm-hmm. And jokingly, I would tell him, you know, it's not Iranian, it's Iranian. Secondly, you're bigger than me, so it's whatever you want it to be, you know. And thirdly, I'm not even Iranian, I'm Italian. Ciao.
So you were trying to pass or become invisible even. How'd that work out for you?
You know, it didn't work out that well because you would try to pass and then your loud immigrant parents would show up and always out you. You know, one thing that I learned early was as a kid, I was a good athlete. That helped. I think that that's around the time that I realized that being funny helped. And I think that that's probably what led me to get into this world of comedy, just trying to make people laugh and accept you. Again, things would go great until your rich Persian dad would pull up in a Rolls Royce to pick you up, and you'd be like, oh, dude.
I love the idea of also your entire family, all your relatives showing up when you had soccer practice.
Oh, my God. It was crazy. It's like I don't know why. I don't know if it's an immigrant mentality. I jokingly say in the car that I think that we're afraid that a revolution is going to happen from the house on the way to picking me up at soccer. So the whole family gets in the car. In case a revolution happens, we could just keep driving to Argentina.
It's funny reading the voice that you give to your relatives in the book. To me, it reads like a traditional Jewish mother voice. Is there something going on there? Is there a similarity? Am I reading that right?
No, you're absolutely right. As a matter of fact, I always explain to people that when I perform in an audience that has immigrants, I think that I find the similarities between Jewish mothers, Middle Eastern, you know, Iranian mothers, Arab mothers, Italian mothers. There's this commonality that they all have. The whole thing of like feeding you, the thing of you know, wanting to find you a wife at a young age, a good wife that they approve of. It's not about who you approve; it's who they approve. You know, them wanting to be a lawyer or a doctor because that's what the community wants. There's so many similarities; it's ridiculous. And it's funny, I've actually been talking about this recently. When I first started with my stand-up, you know, I've been doing stand-up for 17 years, I would talk about being Iranian and, you know, my Iranian parents. But as I kept going, I realized that I started replacing that word with immigrant. Hmm. And that came one night I was doing a joke about how my mother told me, you know, to save my money and where to put my money. And jokingly, I said, you know, we don't put it in 401ks. They encourage us to do what our grandmothers do, which is to put it in our bras. That's where my grandmother would put all her money, in her bra. And as I was telling that joke, there was these two Mexican girls at the Laugh Factory, and they were just cracking up. And I realized, oh, wow, their grandmother puts her money in her bra as well. And it made me realize that we have so many things in common that it's pretty amazing.
Oh, Maz, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Maz Jobrani, he is a comedian. He's an actor. He's a Wait, Don't Tell Me panelist on NPR. And he's out with a new memoir. It's called I'm Not a Terrorist, But I've Played One on TV. There's more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us for States of Play, from board games to grand-scale LARPing. We're going to speak with the head of a Dartmouth game lab that designs and studies tabletop games and the creator of an epic Harry Potter-style roleplay that takes place in an actual castle. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a short break.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth on NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There are parents of girls who swear that although they do nothing to encourage it, their bold and inquisitive little daughters hit the princess phase. That's when every game involves dressing up as a princess and the color pink rules. Mary Flanagan wants to encourage little girls to become leaders. The artist, writer, inventor, and founder of the Tilt Factor Gaming Lab at Dartmouth has designed a new board game. It's called Monarch, and it challenges the heirs to a fictional throne to compete using intelligence and bravery and strength. We spoke to Dr. Flanagan when time was running out on her Kickstarter campaign for the game. We're here to report that it was a success, raising more than $15,000 to produce Monarch. Dr. Mary Flanagan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, before the specifics of your new game, more on this kind of pinkification of children's toys, as you call it. Now, what does that mean?
It means taking something that might be interesting to, across genders and really targeting it towards girls. So when I was in high school, my father bought me colored screwdriver sets that were pink because he thought, well, you know, I might like that better. And I really wanted the nice Stanley kind because they had a very long warranty. So being a practical person and having an adventurer tinkerer kind of life, I've always really resented as a consumer and as a person this oversimplification of who we are through products. And so I've really, you know, I grew up playing Legos and we all know what happened with the Lego story.
The pink and purple girls' Legos.
Right. So I like to just see what happens when we don't do that, when we really leave open the play space to allow some, to allow youth and to allow adults to really explore identity and all of its intricacies.
So I know that you are a researcher as well. Is there any research linking these kind of gender-designed toys and what girls do become interested in, or boys?
Actually, there are some really interesting data points. In 2004, there was a study about playing with Barbie, and researchers found that playing with Barbie actually reduced the way girls could think of their own careers. This research is actually still coming out now, the kind of ways in which we're really shaped by culture, not just games or computer games, but all the things around us, all the representations around us. In fact, representation of like hyper-sexualized women in video games has been linked to believing rape myths. So, like, misunderstanding what rape is actually linked to the way that we see women in games. So these are some pretty big cultural questions that we have going on here.
Well, tell us about Monarch, because it's interesting. You, on the one hand, are talking about how that princess phase or the pinkification is detrimental to the way that girls think, but at the same time, Monarch is about the heirs to a queen, your princesses.
Right. We try to avoid using that term just because it's easier. It doesn't bring as much loaded baggage. But yes, you are playing as sisters vying for the crown. But really, I was really inspired to create this game from looking at women leaders, actually, through history. You know, in part, this was all inspired by my historical research in chess. And there's a really interesting scholar, Marilyn Yalom, who wrote a book called The Birth of the Chess Queen, and it really tracks how the woman on the board, the queen, appeared. You know, she was not an original member of the cast
of
chess.
No, I didn't know that.
And she appeared, the first chess queen appeared in a set that was found in Lewis Island in the 1100s. So Yalom traces the way the queen became a powerful figure on the board to the way that medieval and Renaissance women became more powerful in society.
Let's also talk about the artwork and the strategy and what goes into putting a board game together. It's a lot of work. You've got a lot of pieces laid out here in front of us.
Yes. Well, there are two kinds of ways that people start to design board games. One is more of a mechanics-centered approach, like I want this functionality. And then one is more a theme approach, which is the content. So I tend to be a thematic designer. I really want to match what's happening in the game, what players are doing, to a big picture idea. And so that's what I'm really interested in. Monarch became what it is through a long series of play tests with a lot of adults and children. Every week I was changing something about the game and adding a new feature or changing the balance of numbers of cards and things like that. But Monarch is a game where you, as a player, can use different kinds of strategies to show your worth in ruling the lands. So you rule responsibly, you rule cleverly, and you're able to win.
What was your observation about men playing this game?
Oh, well, that's exactly what we did research on in my research lab, Tilt Factor. We, as the game was being developed, we started asking this question of like, well, do you think we can really get away with using only women as the kind of player characters? And a few hardcore gamers and game publishers actually said, no, we couldn't. We're not in a place where everyone could play as a girl, which is very strange when you think about what's happening in literature, for example. I mean, I don't think only girls, for example, are reading The Hunger Games.
Right.
But there's a little bit of a hesitation on that in board games. So we decided to run some studies. So we did research in a bunch of New Hampshire, Vermont middle schools and high schools with only boys playing the game. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that players, male players who are playing the game, actually, when they get into the characters, actually like the game more than when they're playing as just regular players.
Mm-hmm. This is a board game with different options. You know, there's a level of choose your own adventure based on what is happening, changing the nature of the game based on the choices you make. Now, why did you not design an electronic game for Monarch?
Well, more and more I've been finding, and this is true in my research, at Tilt Factor, we've done several studies about analog versus digital games. We're among the few people who care, actually. So we've done the same game as a digital app, and we've also done it as a board game. And we've found, particularly in a game called Pox Save the People, which is about vaccination, that under the same play conditions, players will actually speak to each other less with a digital game between them than they do with a board game. And they also agree with each other, and they lose the game far more often.
Hmm.
So there's a lot less, I dare say, critical thinking happening when you translate some kinds of gameplay from analog to digital games. And in this case, it was the exact same game played in the exact same conditions. So we do see these differences. I'm really interested in conversations. I'm really interested in people sharing a fantasy world together and creating it, co-creating it. And sometimes a good platform to do that is a board game. And we see this with the increase in board game sales, board game interest, board game cafes. People want to talk to each other and play together.
Mary Flanagan is with us. She's talking about a new game that she's designed called Monarch. She's founding director of Tilt Factor at Dartmouth College. That's a theoretical and practical lab that studies how people play and respond to games and create games for change. Well, so Mary, you mentioned the game Pox. I'd love to know how one designs a game for a public health crisis.
Yeah, well, Pox was designed in 2010, between 2010 and 2011, because a New Hampshire public health group came to the lab and said, you know, we could make another brochure about vaccinations. It doesn't really seem to change hearts and minds. What would? And I thought, well, play. So we created this game that has members of a community out there, and a disease spreads through time, and players work together to stop the virus. So it's a strategy game. It's a little like Go, but a little bit different. It has a 1-4 player kind of setting, and then we decided to move that to an iPad game, and we decided to reskin that game as a zombie game. So we have three versions. We have Zombie Pox, Pox, and Pox Digital. And then, of course, we did studies between them because they're exactly the same game on different platforms. And of all the platforms in all the games, we found that Zombie Pox was actually the most effective at getting people to think about the value of vaccination, even stating they would donate money if they had the means to vaccination, and having people become more empathetic towards those with chronic illness. All that came from a zombie version of the same game. So sometimes outlandish stories, sometimes the most strange stories that distance ourselves from our everyday lives are the most potent as far as belief and behavior.
So Mary, you're talking about designing social games and games for change, as they are labeled. This is something that you do a lot of at Tilt Factor. What goes on there?
Well, Tilt Factor has been around for over 10 years. It's a game design research lab, and it's a place to ask questions about games, games and learning, games and social impact, and not only ask those questions, but create prototypes, test them, and even produce games. So we go anywhere from asking questions about other people's games to asking questions about our own games, and then designing games that actually meet social needs. So, for example, we invent games that can actually lower social biases and discrimination. Mm-hmm. By playing them. Even party games can actually carry psychological change within them.
I was reading a blog post by someone who had seen you. He watched you speak at a conference and heard your frustration about these quote-unquote educational games and games for change, not having enough challenge, not having enough strategy, enough to hold you. What keeps people playing Monarch?
What keeps people playing Monarch? Well, I think because there's a lot of responsiveness in the game system to people's strategy. And you can see, you can chart your own progress really, really well. Monarch is not a, you know, it's not a themed game. It's not saying, oh, play this and you will now be this kind of person. It is really about the fantasy world. It's really about staying in that world, building up your court. The court cards have a little bit of humor. There's a good mix of challenge and strategy built in. And, of course, there's cooperation and healthy competition with your sisters. You know, games are model problem solving. So if we have these intractable global problems and we play games as a way to kind of think through how we think, what if we made games that dealt with more complex systems in a better way? How, you know, not just like, I won, I killed everyone. But like, okay, I won because I managed these three things and made these four people happy and made this happen. I mean, the cause and effect of the world today really needs to be modeled better in the games we play.
Mary Flanagan, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that was Dr. Mary Flanagan, artist, writer, inventor, and founder of the Tilt Factor Gaming Lab at Dartmouth. You can see a short film, some artwork, and more details of the game on the page for the successful Kickstarter campaign. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. There are video games, there are board games, and then there is LARPing. For the uninitiated, LARP stands for Live Action Role Play, and more on what that actually entails in a moment. But while the hobby has been gathering steam here in the U.S., it's pretty much gone mainstream in Denmark. Joining me now to explain how popular Nordic LARPing has become and why is Klaus Rosted. He's an avid LARPer, organizer of large-scale LARPs, and acts as a sort of ambassador for the sport. His recent article, LARP Comes Out of the Shadows, appeared in the travel journal Roads and Kingdoms. Klaus, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
For starters, please describe what LARPing is for us, especially if somebody who doesn't know what it means.
Basically, it's let's pretend. And it can be with kids, it can be with adults, it can be orcs and elves in the forest, it can be about being an executive at an advertising agency. It's organized play.
So what does that look like?
It can look like anything. If you do a LARP about an advertising agency, it's going to look like a scene out of the Mad Men series. While if you do a LARP set in the Star Wars universe, then at best it's going to look like a cheap reproduction of a Star Wars movie.
So you're playing characters, basically.
Yes, yes. It's basically improvised theater without a script.
How would you compare it then to acting or historical reenactments?
If I had to compare it to, I'd say that there's a lot of things in common with acting. But with acting, you're acting for someone else's benefit. You're on some kind of stage and you're trying to portray something. While in LARPing, you're trying to get a feel of the emotions yourselves. So we usually, if we want to use fancy terms, we call what we do participatory art, mm-hmm. as opposed to consumer art. I love watching movies. I love reading books. But when I turn a page and the hero does something that I disagree with, I have no options. Here, I can actually be a part of creating the story. And that's magical.
Well, you've participated in some pretty out there LARPs, and I don't mean the Game of Thrones fantasy kind. What are some of the roles that you have played?
Well, I've played in something inspired by the occupation of Iraq. I played a peacekeeping trooper, and that was a little bit different to get a feel for that. Of course, it's nothing like being in Iraq, but you get a little sense of some of the difficulties faced by these people. I've played a snack bar owner on a Muslim spaceship in 2854. That was a little bit strange, but fun.
What is the background for these roles? I mean, do a bunch of people agree to get together and do a LARP?
Yes. Basically, you have some people who have some kind of creative vision. That could be me, for instance, or other people. And we will find a location for it, and we'll find some kind of basic fiction, and we'll invite people to come and be a part of it. Hmm. So my next big project is a wizard school at a castle in Poland. So what we've done is basically we've rented a whole castle, which is a hotel by day, And we rented the whole thing and paid some extra to ensure there are no tourists. And then we invite people from all over the world to come and play witches and wizards at this magical college.
Well, you're raising money for this now. It's a big Harry Potter LARP. Let's hear.
It's not Harry Potter.
Oh, okay.
It's
sorry.
Inspired by, at least. No. The reason I stress this is due to our deal with Warner Brothers, who has the rights for it. That it's definitely not Harry Potter, but it's inspired by it and by other magical universes.
All right. So let's hear a promotional video for the next wizard event.
Like many of us my age, used to be a Harry Potter fan when I was a kid. And then this game pops up and it's like reliving my teenage years again.
When I saw this, it was like, oh my God, I just have to be there.
Incontinentia! Very nice, we'll do it once more.
In the promotional video, people get to see the look of the castle and the costumes used. Really, absolutely stunning. What else do you have to figure out in order to make a LARP like this pull off?
One thing is you have to have some kind of background fiction. Are we in Rome in the 2nd century? Are we at a wizard school? Are we in space, wherever? And you have to have some kind of structure to make it interesting. In this case, we built the whole structure of the school, how it functions with classes and rivalries between the different sororities, fraternities, and somebody teaches, somebody has lessons. Are there monsters in the forest? What's going on? You have to construct the experience, so to speak.
This is really caught on in the Nordic countries, apparently. What do you think distinguishes the Nordic LARPing scene from others?
There are several things that distinguish the Nordic LARP scene. One is that in the Nordic countries, life is rather safe in general. A lot of people go to some of the kind of, so we say, darker aspects of art to get those experiences because life is rather safe and comfortable in general. That's one thing. Another is that we have a state that funds art activities and culture activities quite a lot. So we're not necessarily dependent on private sponsors to get things running. And thirdly, we don't suffer too much from what I'd call American masculinity culture, mm-hmm. which basically says that anything outside the mainstream is for nerds and they should be beaten up and they have no sex lives or social lives. We can also see this when we get media coverage that while in the Nordic countries, what we do is treated as culture. In some of the American media it is, but in some of it it's like, see all these nerds. We should all gather them in one place and laugh at them because they are strange. See, they play and enjoy it. And luckily, we don't suffer as much from that in the Nordic countries. There's still some of it, but it's not as bad. And it means that doing something that's different and strange and requires a big investment is something you're actually allowed to do without becoming a social pariah.
Klaus Rosted, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're more than welcome.
Klaus Rosted, he's an author, an avid LARPer, and you'll find a link to his latest project, which is crowdfunding a wizard-style LARP called The College of Wizardry. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, we did have a brief thaw this week, but are now back in the grips of winter weather. Up next, we're going to demystify one of winter's impressive and sometimes dangerous creations, icicles. That's when Word of Mouth returns after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It has been a brutal winter here in the Northeast, and all of that packed snow on rooftops has made for some impressive, in some cases, scary icicles on display. But let's consider the icicle for a moment. Where do they come from, and what accounts for their distinctive shape? There is a surprising amount that we do not know about icicles, but here to explain some of what we do know is NHPR's Sam Evans-Brown. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Virginia.
So what can you tell us about icicles, eh?
Eh? So I think we should start with you know, just think about the shape of an icicle.
What, you mean pointy at the end and wider at the base?
Yeah.
Wait, was that Taylor?
Yeah, that was Taylor Quimby. He's one of the producers on the show, and he and another producer, Logan Shannon, and I all went for a little icicle viewing walk to talk about icicle science.
Okay, so let's get back to this big question. Why this shape? Why the long, skinny icicles instead of big globs or sheets of ice like you might see, you know, coming off granite on the side of the highway?
Right, so the key thing is that icicles are long and skinny because the tip is growing faster than the base.
What? Okay, but why?
Well, there are basically three big reasons for why that is. Right? So thing number one is it's dripping.
Mm-hmm.
Every drip as it goes carries heat away. right?
Right.
Right? Because water is this incredible vehicle for carrying heat. It's got the highest specific heat of any material that we know of. So it's carrying heat away from the tip. Also, the heat tends to rise. And so the heat, as it is given off by this water, rises up, and you get this like pocket of warm air that's thicker toward the top of the icicle and very thin toward the tip. So the water that's dripping down toward the top of the icicle is sort of insulated by this little pocket of warm air that is formed by the heat given off by the rest of the ice freezing. And then as you get farther down, there's less and less protection, more and more likely that it'll freeze. And then the third thing is just the base tends to be more sheltered than the tip, right? So if wind is blowing, the tip is out there and exposed, and the base is just a tiny bit more sheltered. So you've got those three factors that mean the tip is losing heat more quickly than the base. So at the base of the icicle, the water is less likely to freeze. At the tip, it's more likely. It's freezing more quickly. It grows into a long, pointy shape.
So interesting. But I'm still stuck on this fact that this is a phenomenon of our built environment. I mean, I have images of old Currier and Ives, you know, snow-laden trees dripping with icicles.
They're an artifact of our built environment. They're an artifact of heat leaking out of buildings. They're an artifact of poorly insulated roofs, mostly.
So obviously, if you have more icicles dripping off your eaves, it probably means you have more heat escaping.
Right. And so this is the, you know, up in Saranac Lake, New York, they have a biggest icicle contest every year, and the winner wins a free home energy audit.
That makes perfect sense. Well, I've seen some contenders this year.
Yeah. Now, next time you see an icicle, get yourself a ruler, hold it up to the icicle, and count how often the ripples appear. And you will see that you'll get a ripple every centimeter. And it's always that way, and they have no idea why.
Why?
What
they know. What did they think?
Well, the one we've really broken our heads on is the ripples.
So Stephen Morris is the ice guru. He's a professor at the University of Toronto.
My specialty is ice formations and icicles and patterns in nature and stuff.
Of course.
Right. Where else would you study icicle? He also studies a lot of other funny things. He studies the patterns that cracks form in mud when mud starts to dry up. And he studies washboard roads and the frequency of the bumps in washboard roads, things like that. So an interesting guy.
Uh-huh.
And so we discovered that the strange fact is that pure water icicles made of distilled water don't form these ripples, but even a tiny, tiny amount of impurity, like tap water or a tiny little pinch of salt in your water, and then the icicle will grow ripples. So we don't have any understanding of where the ripples come from, really. They somehow depend on the presence of a tiny little bit of salt in the water, but why that would produce ripples, we don't know. That's one of the main unexplained features of icicle shapes.
That is so bizarre. I mean, talk about the golden rule. There's a really distinct pattern.
And they're working towards this sort of unified theory of icicle formation.
That will explain the entire universe.
Right.
Well, it doesn't work at all, actually. At the moment, we predict that ripples of infinitely small wavelength will grow infinitely fast. So this is a kind of catastrophe that happens to theories. They predict infinity. Okay, so when that happens, it means you have something missing from your mathematics.
So do you need, like, you know, a fresh wave of icicle researchers with, you know, fresh eyes to look at this problem and sort of infuse?
Well, something tells me that wave is not about to appear. It's our job. We're going to keep trying and work on different aspects of it. Eventually, I think we'll solve it eventually, but it may take some time.
So okay, this is another frequently asked salt or icicle question.
How do you get rid of ice?
I've
heard loaves of bread.
Loaves? I haven't heard that one.
Yes, loaves of French bread.
And you just put it up there?
Yes.
It just melts it?
Well, you know, who doesn't want to stop for some French bread?
Well, what I've also heard, fill, you know, a sock or some pantyhose full of, you want to use calcium chloride, not salt, because salt will damage your shingles. But, and you just stick it up there in your gutters or stick it up on the ice floe and it'll slowly, you know, work
melt
its way through.
I mean, I'm sort of obsessed with I want to smash all of these icicles. Like, I'm not a violent person, but I think it's really fun to smash icicles.
I mean, I think everybody wants to smash them, right?
Yeah. But is it a bad idea? Like, if you have a bunch of icicles hanging off your house, should you smash them?
So the standard recommendation is that you should be very careful as you remove them because you don't want to damage your roof, right? So if you just smash it and it's frozen to, you know, your drip edge, for instance, and you break off a piece of your drip edge or you break some of your shingles, then you've damaged your roof and your roof's an important part of your house. But you can take them off if you're willing to just be careful. You shouldn't. I would imagine you shouldn't just go with a shovel and start whacking at it, unless you
some, I did that exactly this, and I broke off a piece of the window.
Oh.
2 weeks ago. It was a huge icicle. I couldn't help myself.
Oh my gosh, it's so tempting.
They are.
When you think about an icicle, the reason people don't think, oh man, I need to act right now, is because they don't look at them and they don't think of them as the symbol of you know, the problems
fungus
with your house.
Right.
Exactly. It's just like, oh, this is a nice thing that everybody has. But really, you know, now that you know that they're a symptom that your roof isn't very well insulated and that indeed they're going to lengthen or reduce the life of your shingles, you start to look at them a different way. They're very menacing.
Get yourself a pair of pantyhose. That's NHPR's education and environment reporter Sam Evans-Brown, demystifying icicles. And we'd love to hear from you. Did you have any epic icicles dangling from your eaves this winter? How'd you get rid of them? And did you take any photos? Shoot us an email and let us know. Our address, wordofmouth@nhpr.org. You can also tell us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. If you've ever worked a 9-to-5 job, spent any time in a cubicle, or even had roommates, you're probably familiar with a common yet deeply personal violation. And the podcast, The Sporkful, is airing a 3-part investigation into the epidemic, office fridge theft.
So my dinner shift comes up. I'm looking forward to this pizza, of all things. I open it, and one slice is missing. Just one.
Heather wrote it off. Lots of people in the office ordered from Schlotsky's. Maybe it was an honest mistake. Turned out, it was just the beginning.
The 6-inch sub. That's the one that nailed it.
And that is where the investigation begins. In 2001, when Heather Coleman became a victim. Dan Pashman is host of WNYC's podcast, The Sporkful, and is here to talk about Heather's case and the broader politics and morality of office food theft. Dan Pashman, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks, Virginia.
All right. So what happened to Heather's 6-inch sub?
Well, it's quite a tale. So a third of the sandwich disappeared, and this happened repeatedly. And not only did her food keep disappearing, but it was always, as she says, always only a part of the food, not the whole thing, which was especially perplexing for her.
So how often did this happen?
Well, it happened a lot when she first started this job. Once every few weeks on a regular basis, it was really tormenting her, keeping her awake at night. Finally, she just stopped using the communal fridge because she couldn't figure out who was doing it. And she went to extreme lengths. I mean, way beyond just leaving nasty notes like many people have done. She took a sandwich and put it in a plastic container and wrapped the whole container in duct tape. And the thief sliced through the duct tape.
No.
Eventually, the thief got careless. Is what happened.
Okay. Well, let's just talk episode by episode here, because we're in the first episode. We discover that, like you said, the culprit would just take little pieces. So what do you think the motive is in that case? Why not just eat the whole thing?
Well, that's something that we explore in this episode of the Sporkful podcast. And I actually talked to a guy named Baron Ambrosia, who hosts a show on Cooking Channel, and is himself in his show occasionally a food thief. And I try to get into the mind of this person, the motive. And what he says, and I'm inclined to agree, he says, this is not a crime of hunger because the person didn't finish the food. It's not a crime of culinary curiosity. You know, it's not like this is such an exotic delicacy, I must have some, because it's like a turkey club sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not the reason. He thinks that the reason is basically an underlying need for intimacy.
Oh.
That it's about intimacy. That what this food thief is doing is sort of 2 steps away from sniffing someone's chair.
The pathology gets thicker and thicker. I mean, I would
That's
think
right.
this almost like, I don't know, I would almost think somebody had a food disorder if they did, just as happened to Heather, just took the chicken out of a burrito. I mean, something else is going on here.
Yeah, no, there's certainly, this is not your run-of-the-mill food theft story. This thing, and I want to stress, it is really a true story. Heather's story is a true story. People have listened to the podcast and they're like, why'd you pick Elkhart, Indiana? And I'm like, because that's where it happened. So it is a true story, and it is very strange. So she has this burrito that gets just mangled. Normally this food thief is very meticulous, but then the thief gets careless and leaves this burrito like, I mean, just like the burrito's torn open, but everything is left there except the chicken. The food thief picked out the chicken and left the rest there for all to see.
Mm. Well, let's hear a clip of Heather's reaction to some of the incidents. This one I find quite interesting.
Food is so personal. Like, for example, if someone used up, like, all my Kleenex or all my Post-its, I would just go get another one and it would be no big deal. But the touching of my food, I really felt violated.
There is an emotional response there, and I'm thinking that the response to food does really outweigh the severity of a crime. I mean, if you really think about it, it's a six of a Subway sandwich or a slice of pizza. I mean, why is it so emotional?
That's right. I mean, it's not in reality, it's not like it's irreplaceable. But there is something very personal and intimate about food. And there's something, this is something I've heard from a lot of Sporkful listeners in working on this series, is that there's also something that happens when you are looking forward to food that you have in the fridge. Like if it's leftovers or something special you brought in from home.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to a woman in Florida who's very upset because she had this gourmet salsa that someone went to town on. You know, and so when you're looking forward to it and then you find that it's not there, it's that much more painful.
Mm. Well, one of my colleagues, she brought in some almond butter, fresh, you know, new jar of almond butter, and discovered it had been opened, the seal had been taken off of it, and a big knife full of almond butter had been taken out of it. And she started thinking, you know, what kind of monsters do I work with? You start looking at everybody who works with you as suspect.
That's right. That's right. And that's something I'm going to get into more in part two. We hear more stories of office fridge food thievery. And we even have it here at WNYC also.
Mm.
There's a famous story in these halls about the kombucha fairy who replaced some stolen kombucha. That was a big scandal.
Uh-huh.
But it is, and I've never heard anything like that. That's extreme. For someone to open a sealed container is extreme. But one of the things we get to in next week's episode of The Sporkful is a debate over whether it's ever okay. You know, because I was surprised how many Sporkful listeners wrote in and said, actually, I think in this situation, that situation, taking someone else's food is okay.
Okay, so what is okay? I mean, I kind of think, where do you stand on condiments, for example, like salad dressing and butter?
I think you should try hard not to take other people's. Like, you should never bring in a dry salad banking on the fact that you know that this other guy always has his vinaigrette. But if you're in a pinch and you need a condiment and you didn't bring it yourself, I think, look, if it's a small amount, it's not the worst thing you could do. And I've done that a few times, and I'm sure it's been done to me. If you're the kind of person who absolutely cannot handle anyone touching or even taking a drop of your ketchup or salad dressing, then don't put food in the office fridge.
Mm-hmm. How about
you do have to assume a basic amount of risk.
So condiments, meh. But when do you cross the Rubicon or into really egregious office food theft?
I think any time that you are taking someone's actual like entree food, a piece of a sandwich or pizza or anything like that, like you're actually taking a portion of their meal, you've crossed a line. I think if you're talking about a condiment, a rogue peanut, it's not the worst thing in the world. But when you're eating someone else's sandwich, you've crossed the line. You know, people have a funny way of justifying their own behavior a lot of times. Sometimes there can be revenge food theft. Sometimes people are just selfish. But I have a guy in next week's show who says that he thinks it's a public service sometimes. Because the way he argues it, he says, look, there's only so much space in the fridge. If people have clogged the fridge up with a bunch of stuff that they're not finishing, A, I'm helping the community by clearing space in the fridge, and B, I'm eating something that would otherwise have gone bad and been thrown out.
We're laughing about this. It is a really funny situation on some level, but people do get really mad about it. But it is theft, after all. So is there an indication, do you think, that if somebody's going to open up your almond butter and steal a knifeful or take the chicken out of your burrito, is there something else at play here? Another kind of theft?
I mean, I think if you're talking about something pathological like Heather's story, or I mean, I think opening up someone's container of almond butter is extreme. I'd like to think that there's space in society for us to all sort of share condiments and salsa to a basic extent without seeing accusations of theft thrown around. I mean, can we all just eat along?
Dan Pashman, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Virginia.
Dan Pashman is host of the WNYC podcast, The Sporkful, and there is a 3-episode serial-style treatment of office fridge theft currently online. You could look at wordofmouthradio.org to hear it. He's also author of the book Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious. And we would love to hear your thoughts on office fridge theft. Have you ever taken a squirt of someone else's salad dressing? Is a tub of butter fair game? Or have you been the victim of office fridge theft? Join the ongoing conversation at facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's so much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show or have trouble catching Word of Mouth in the middle of the day, you can catch up with the show in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org, or you can search Word of Mouth NHPR on iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow too, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray,
with help from our intern,
Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.